Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Richard Rossi Live. Very excited about our guest that will be calling in here momentarily. John Putch has really quite a background. His father, Bill Putch, was a pioneer. An entrepreneur, a pioneer, a theater impresario, really. He ran for 30 years a theater in Pennsylvania, in near Gettysburg, where I used to love to go. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. His mother, we all loved her as Edith Bunker on All in the Family. So John started in the business very young as a child actor, and now he's a maverick director and has his feet in both sides of show business, both in the mainstream world, has directed a lot of television, episodic shows, a lot of well-known shows, as well as now doing many of his own indie films. And he also has a seminar coming up here very soon on how to make your own independent film that will cover pre-production, production, post-production, how to do things on a micro-budget. He's had his feet, like I say, in both worlds, kind of by day a mainstream director and by night doing his own passion films centered around our mutual home state of Pennsylvania. So I'll be back in 20 seconds with John Putch, and don't go anywhere. It's going to be a really interesting interview, especially for those of you with an interest in film and in the entertainment industry. Be back in a second with John. Richard. Welcome, John.
Hey.
Welcome to the show, John. We're live, and thank you so much. We're all excited about you being on today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. Pleasure. Like it. Anything underground and not mainstream is my cup of tea.
Well, it's interesting. I saw, such the same spirit, pioneering spirit, particularly in your father. I know this story, and I'm very touched by this story, and we have a lot of mutual friends from Pennsylvania that are part of the story. But for our listeners that don't know, we know your mother from All in the Family, and my wife and I, shed a tear when that came over the news that she passed, just so beloved. But a lot of folks don't know your father as well was, talk about a pioneer. Can you tell them a little bit about, the 30-year run he had with the Totem Pole Playhouse?
Sure. My father is from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and he went to Carnegie Tech, and then he went on the I think he went on the GI Bill to go to Carnegie Tech when he came back from the war, and then soon after that he started teaching at the Pittsburgh Playhouse School of Theater, and he ran that for a little while, and then he answered an ad in a theater arts magazine. About a summer theater in South Central PA looking for an artistic director, and he went out there in 1953 and shook hands with the board and walked into his first 11-play season in 1954, and from 54 to 1983 until his untimely death, he fostered and nurtured that theater called Totem Pole Playhouse, where he produced and directed and, did about over 300 shows. Mm. And, my family spent our lives there. That's where we grew up. My sister and I both got our training there. My mother performed there, obviously. And they were married as a result of them meeting in the theater. And there we go. And so his legacy is still there, and that's kind of one of the reasons I head back there to make these indie films. I love going back to that part of the country. Mm. And doing kind of what he did with his low-budget theater, I'm doing the same kind of thing with my micro-budget movies. They're just a collective experience with a bunch of talented people who are not in it for the money.
Yeah, it really comes through. I was thinking that, too, that you have, like, your own troupe, and a lot of the great film directors the European masters, Bergman, a lot of those guys had the same troupe in the film world. But a lot of times, probably the episodic world, you've directed a lot of TV. you know, even though you've done so well in that world, was there a part of you that maybe creatively wasn't quite satisfied and wanted to create, as your father did, a sense of, you know, that company, that theater company?
Yeah, sure. You know, when you come out of theater and you learn about ensemble, and nobody's better than the whole of the play and the production, and you're thrown into, you know, Los Angeles and Hollywood and television, where it is not that. It's basically who can sell the most tickets is the most powerful person involved, and then egos seem to pop up everywhere. It's a culture shock. And, you know, I spent years as an actor working out here, involved in television and movies, whatever I could get. And it seemed unusually wrong the way everything was set up. It had nothing to do with your talent. It had mostly to do with your either how you looked or who you knew or, you know, what. Yeah, who knows? I mean, just what the beard you had that day. It's just all very strange. So coming from, you know, the theatrical background, I had to adjust to that, and it took me years. And then when I started directing, I realized I could not change the system because it was kind of the same. So, you know, at some point, some people smarter than me and younger than me figured this out. It took me a while to figure it out. But at some point, you just throw up your hands and go, okay, this is how this works out here. This machine goes this way. It's not anything like I've been taught. But I'm going to call it what it is. And in order to feel good about what I did, what I do, I need to go off and create things on my own. And in about, I'd say, 2005, I'd come back from South Africa. I just directed a big miniseries for NBC, and I was quite happy and proud of the shoot. And when I got back, the executive producer and, you know, the person in charge obviously had his way with the piece and the cut, and in my opinion, destroyed it. And but that's when I realized, all right, the director is definitely not in control when you're hired by anyone. So I decided to break off and go backwards and basically try to reconnect with what it felt like when I made Super 8 movies as a high schooler, or, you know, 16mm films as I was coming up. And it's at that point that I realized, oh, I can, here's the medium I can use to be creative and make the films the way I want to make them, and I will be held responsible whether they flourish or whether they fail. At least I will, you know, the director or the, you know, the filmmaker will be the reason, and that's okay with me because the process itself is so satisfying that good, bad, or indifferent, I feel like the best stuff I do is when I'm, you know, doing it this way.
Mm.
That was a long-winded answer for that question. Sorry about that.
Well, very profound one, though, and very educational to you know, filmmakers that are listening. And you know, what's really interesting to me, one of the many things about you, John, is I think you've bridged kind of the worlds. Your family kind of went into both worlds. I love the documentary on your dad and the early home movies, and your mom was, you know, talking about keeping the books, and then, you know, lo and behold, she becomes very famous with, you know, All in the Family, and your dad, I think I got the feeling he had some of those, that he handled that very well, but at the same time that he had some of those same feelings about the industry when he came out here. That I looked at your dad when I saw the film. He reminded me of like a really, you know, good doctor in a small town, or good minister, or someone that just gave their heart and soul to a town. And you know, you've been able to bridge both worlds, both the world that your mother you know, had to go into and did so well in terms of mainstream, but you also have done what your father has done and kind of being the, you know, patriarch of this collective of people that have made these three Route 30 films. I think you've really done an amazing job of juggling both worlds, really.
Thanks. Well, as I put it, as people say that plainly, I work in the coal mines of television. I call them my coal mine, where, you know, you go underground and you shovel coal and you bring it to the surface and it's given away to somebody else. And mm-hmm. and then I take the earnings from the coal mine and I go off into the woods with a script, a camera, and some friends and make some good stuff with it. And I'm absolutely fine with that because mm-hmm. they're completely separate. And one helps me get through the other. They actually mm. both help each other out. One funds them, and the other one cleanses. So it's great. I just hope I can keep it up, and, you know, I hope they don't put me out to pasture and in the coal mine too soon, so I can keep going there, you know, and pulling the stuff out I need to go off and make my movies. But I got to say, you know, you're either in it, you know, when you're a filmmaker, you either want to say something or you want to be famous like an actor would, and you want to be the ego comes in and you want to see your movie in a theater, or you'd like to tell people that you direct a television show, or, you know, it's human nature to want people to like you and, you know, look at you, and I think that's what this business really draws, that type of person. So when I give my little rant or my little seminar to those sitting in front of me, I always have to preface it by saying you're either a filmmaker or you want to be a celebrity, and it's mm-hmm. no different than the way some actors feel as well. And you have to decide, because I do not believe art and commerce can coexist. I think you got to go for the commerce and be that person and pretend that you're doing, you know, wonderful things, or you got to be the person that just can't take that behavior and has to tell a story. I find that documentaries might be the purest form of film there is anymore, because there's literally, it's truth being presented to you in a dramatic fashion, and there's really no place for to go off the rails unless you decide not to tell the truth, and I find those to be the most satisfying film experience to date as we go forward in the world. But, you know, the art and commerce thing is, you know, it's just the way it is. Remember that in 1981, you may not know this, in 1981, that Michael Eisner, who was the CEO of Disney, remember, he brought Disney back mm-hmm. from whatever it was. There's a memo, it's been going around the Internet for years, but the memo says, we have no obligation to make history, we have no obligation to make art, we have no obligation to make a statement, to make money as our only objective. This quote from the CEO of a motion picture studio. He's right. That's what they are. They are corporations, and they are supposed to make money. You know, hiding behind entertainment, fine. But, you know, just don't pretend to be an art film when you're not. That's my big beef with – one of my beefs with Hollywood.
But that's, make money is our only objective. And
yes.
It's great that you're sharing what you've learned in the trenches. That leads into you know, what your seminar is called, which is making the anti-Hollywood movie. In other words, you're going to share these realities in, I guess, about 10 days or so in your seminar, which is in the D.C. area, right?
Yeah, it's in Arlington, Virginia on March 22nd. It's at the Hyatt. It's at 11 a.m., and the info can be found at putchfilms.com if anyone's interested in that area. But, yeah, when I call it the anti-movie, anti-Hollywood movie, what I mean is they can't do these films this way. They don't know how, and they're not capable. And that's because the cost is so low. The main objective is not ticket sales, but the main objective is to tell a good story in a form that is, you know, cinematic, and it's doing everything the way you're told you're not supposed to, and that's okay. And I'm the guy who's done it the way you're supposed to for years, and now I'm the guy saying, oh, please let's do it differently, just because we can, and let's not make decisions based on ticket sales or what you've been taught or told over the years. You can't use that color for your poster art. You know, you can't cast that actor in the lead role. No one knows who they are. You know, it's the list goes on. So The anti-Hollywood way is like, get the best actors, tell the best story, use the best people you know to do it, and it doesn't take, you know, millions of dollars to do it. You can make a dandy movie for you know, $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. Just pick the level you're most comfortable with and design your script to fit into that budget. It's fun.
I love how you also incorporated so much of the, you know, the culture, the landscape of that whole Gettysburg area and Chambersburg area with the Elephant Store and the Round Barn and so much of those. I love some of the actresses. I think it was an actress, Bridget, that had just such a quintessential Pittsburgh voice. It just brought back a feeling of being back in Western Pennsylvania where I grew up. And you did such a great job of it being those, the Route 30 films being very indigenous to the culture, including the locals, the feel.
Well, yeah, and that's part of my digital rules is utilize your resources. If, you know, here's an example, like I utilize South Central PA in my hometown of Chambersburg and Gettysburg and Fayetteville to because A, I know it so well, I live there. B, it's beautiful. There's locations there that no one's ever seen on a movie screen. And also you, if you're uncle owns the Ford dealership. Guess where your main character is going to work? At the Ford dealer, because you've got production value, and your uncle says, come in here and shoot for free. So that's why when I mentioned you reverse engineer your script into what you have at your disposal, all of a sudden great ideas come out of just nowhere. You go, oh, my God, this is incredible. He can work at the Ford dealer. Or she can work at that restaurant that's so great, or that bar or something that I'm allowed to shoot at, rather than the opposite. Most people sit and they'll write their script, and you know, they'll just sit and come up with fictional everything and not actually even have in mind a place. And then you go to try to make your movie, and it's impossible because you've written stuff into it that you cannot possibly get. That includes props and locations and, you know, things that occur on screen. So I'm trying to get people in the mindset of that you got to start the opposite. You got to, like, sit down and look around what you have access to in your life, no matter where you are, and use that and create a story around it. And, well, it's unbelievable what comes out. Just great ideas just, like, jump right to the front. And then you get really excited and because you feel like you're getting away with something, because you didn't do it the opposite way. You did it basically the wrong way, which I like.
Oh, you've done a wonderful job. My son and I were watching one of the Route 30 films last night, and he said, man, this just takes us back to home. He had such a feeling of home in Pennsylvania. And some of the bits in the films just had us laughing so hard. One thing that had me hysterical was the whole Christian Scientist bit. I think Will Love was the actor, and one of the guys hurts his back, and he's the juxtaposition of the theological, you know, view that pain doesn't exist, and the guy's looking at him like, "Are you crazy? My back is killing me right now." That was really fun. How did you come up with that?
Well, hey, listen, that story is so. I love that story because I lived that story because I grew up. My mother was a Christian Scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And like the character in the movie, in that piece, and that kind of stuff occurred constantly. If you grew up in a Christian Science religion, that kind of odd, weirdo, illogical, nonsensical behavior would occur in the name of, you know, spirituality. And I always thought it was humorous. And
yeah, it's great you,
see,
you have that that kind of quirky sense of humor, because I find so much about religion funny. And, you know, most of my friends and family can laugh at the humor I find in it, but some people are offended by it. But I thought you had that humor to it. And, you know, I know this is a rabbit trail, but I wondered, you know, got me thinking about the belief that pain and death doesn't exist. And I thought, well, what do they do when someone dies? The founder, you know, Mary Baker Eddy obviously died or whatever. And I thought, well, maybe they would say the real spirit lives, but the body is an illusion or matter is an illusion, so the death never really happened. But I don't know how they explain that.
Well, the body is never, in Christian Science, the human form, the physiology, is not acknowledged as being important at all.
Mm-hmm.
So the body means nothing. So when you pass on, you're not gone. You the vessel you were in is just gone.
Okay.
Your spirit is still around, and you're still a living thing.
Mm.
So at least that's
okay.
How I perceived it when I went to Sunday school. Oh, those many years!
Wow, that's so fascinating.
But yeah,
and it's
so
interesting.
Oh, it's fascinating. And every child of Christian Science, and this is, you know, by the way, there are things about it that are wonderful and have
mm-hmm.
made a positive impact on my thought process as an adult.
Yes.
But there's just something about it that's slightly off. And
yeah.
And as a child of Christian Science, every child of Christian Science will always tell you the same story. If one of your parents is a scientist and the other one is not, you'll always have the same experience of hearing them argue in the hall while you're sick with the measles or the mumps or a fever.
Man.
You'll always hear one going, "I can take care of this," and the other one going, "He needs to go to the hospital." You know,
yeah.
There's every Christian Science kid has that story. And we had it too, and that's why there's so many little things in that piece in Route 30, Part 1, about, you know, someone would sneak in and put eardrops in my ear when I was, you know, when the other person wasn't looking, and, you know, there's all sorts of stuff. But it's a fun little one of the chapters in Part 1 that I'm glad you liked, because it's really funny. And you know what? Audiences love it. Because
yeah, I was laughing.
General,
I played it three times, John. I actually brought people in you know, in my home. I stopped at that point. I was calling in friends and neighbors. I was like, "You have to see this scene. It's so funny."
That's good.
Yeah,
no, that's
and
good. And
religion is so funny. The denial, you know, I'm not laying here with my back twisted in pain. This is not happening.
Yeah,
but,
and by the way,
like,
for anyone who's curious, my mom did see the film and was absolutely howling throughout.
Mm.
So. It's I'm not. I don't feel bad about.
Yeah.
The portrayal, I believe, was innocuous and not mean-spirited
yeah.
at all. So I want to make sure, you know.
Well, she had such a great comedic ability, and I'm sure that she gleaned the positive, you know, side of it, because I think it was Rob Reiner or somebody I heard talking about your mom and said that her faith and her background. Was great in film and in doing that show, because with all the egos and the negativity that can come in with network television, that, you know, she really was committed to, I don't want to think and say negative things, you know, and they found that, you know, that she really, really tried to walk on the positive, loving side of things, which in Hollywood to them was really refreshing.
Yeah, she was that. There is no question. She did not let this business get to her, or she was impervious to it because of who she was and how she held herself. But
mm-hmm.
she also was an actress, and she was not ever a celebrity in her mind. I mean, she came from a, you know, a really working, almost lower class family in New York, and she had to support her mother and father for years when she was out of high school. After the stock market crash and stuff, and you know, it was work ethic, and she always came to every role offered her as an actress, and not a person, you know, who needed to throw their weight around, and that remained until she stopped working well into her 80s, and that's why she had such a great reputation, because that other stuff, that ego stuff, was really not ever present in her. And I wish, you know, I work with a lot of egos when I direct television these days, and you know, writers, actors, crew members, everybody's included in that. And there's a lot of people with egos that really should take note of Jean Stapleton and how she behaved. But, you know, there's no, you know, you can't, you know, can't change those, can't change all that. You just got to figure out how to navigate through it and make the best of everything.
Well, what's the best way for someone that you'd recommend for them to find the Route 30 films to find out about the seminar? Is it all through your main website?
Well, I'd give you two. The seminar is putchfilms.com. There's a link right there. It takes you right to the info.
Okay.
And for the Route 30 movies, I would go to Route30Trilogy.com. That's R-O-U-T-E, the number 30, and then trilogy.com. And that's a portal to all three movies. The first two that have been made, they can be streamed, purchased, whatever you want to do. And then the third one, that one's the premiere will be this summer, this August in Gettysburg. So there'll be all sorts of information about that. And there's a lot of good behind-the-scenes video on these sites for the micro-budget films. So if anyone's interested in looking at how big or how small I like to do things, you just go to the video pages of these sites and you'll see a lot of fun, great stuff. Stuff that's on the DVDs and some that is not.
Yeah, the extras were great on the first Route 30. The documentary on your dad was just so touching to me. And on the second one, there's so much to be gleaned, which will be the subject of your upcoming seminar on making the anti-Hollywood movie. But there was, I noticed you had great background footage on pre-production, post-production, production. You really got a feel of the process, like you're with the crew going through it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I love that stuff. I mean, that's me as a movie file, you know, when I rent a DVD or used to rent a DVD, the first thing I would watch is the behind-the-scenes programs. And there was a time before the marketing departments got a hold of this arm of DVDs where the actual filmmaker was responsible for that behind-the-scenes stuff. Mm. But when the studios took over and started using their marketing department to use it as things to sell DVDs with, you lost all of the good information, in my opinion. And that is this, how stuff is done and the secrets behind the scenes and stuff. And so I like to put that in my DVDs and all over the web. And, again, in my seminar, no one tells the truth about what goes on out here. And I plan to, and I do, in this seminar, all the way through distribution. So I got a lot to say about what happens to your movie when you finish it.
Well, those
of
you in the D.C. area, go to putchfilms.com, and you know, as the good book says, the truth will set you free. And I believe if you spend this day with John, you know, the truth that he will tell you will set you free to produce your own film and you know, take that script out of the drawer and figure out how to do it. And thank God in this digital age, you know, that in this age that we can go out now with a digital camera and edit on our laptops, and it's a little bit easier in a way, isn't it, John, than when we had. Yeah.
I can't tell you how great it is now. I actually can make movies now as whenever I want. I can make them for $5. I can make them for $5,000. These cameras and this equipment and the editing at home, oh, my God. A film I made in 99 that went to Sundance and got that whole thing. Was $300,000. I mortgaged my house. It was shot on film. You had to do everything the old-fashioned way. I had to pay other people to do everything. Film, whatever. That same movie today I could make for $25,000.
Wow.
And that's why it's like this HD digital revolution that began in like the early 2002 or 3 or whenever it did, when the first HDV camera came out, 2004 maybe, is when it all changed for us. And, yeah, now there's no reason not to make your movie. No, none. Because you can't say, well, I can't, the equipment is not professional and I can't get professional equipment. That's gone. So now there's the only thing holding you back is you and maybe a credit card. So, yeah.
Well, it's been such a joy visiting with you. The 30 minutes has flown by, and I can't wait for the third one. Who knows? We're planning to visit family in the summer. Maybe we can bring a couple carloads up from Pittsburgh for the premiere of the third one, which will be in August in Gettysburg.
That's right, August 2nd and 3rd at Gettysburg Majestic Theater, right on the square in Gettysburg, PA. Tickets are on sale now. It's going to be awesome.
Fantastic.
I'd love to see you there. Bring boatloads. Or tell your friends, but it's going to be wild. It'll be fun.
Well, thank you so much for being here, John.
Sure thing.
And all of you listening, you can get more information at Putch Films, P-U-T-C-H, films.com on the Route 30 films. Route 30 is a road that runs in that area through Pennsylvania. I think it's called the Lincoln Highway. I'm not sure.
That's right.
It's the Lincoln Highway. Yeah. That's Route 30 Trilogy to get John's films. Route, R-O-U-T-E, 30, the number. 30 Trilogy, TRILOGY.com. Thank you, John, for being here.
Sure thing, Richard. I appreciate it. Thanks for the time.
Okay, and best wishes on
right.
10 days on the seminar, Making the Anti-Hollywood
Thanks.
Movie. And thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll be back on air tomorrow at 10 a.m. with Dale Gertnick, who wrote the best-selling book on the Pittsburgh Steelers.